Chapter 9. Traitor to Mankind. Those who affect masks and steal their way through shadows and take the names of others as their own are more deadly than any blooded warriors. Galen on Espeel.
"The lion?" asked Warsmith Dantioch softly. "The lion himself? Is it true?"
A degree of trial and error had allowed them to permanently stabilize the vision of primary location Alpha in the Chapel of Memorial, adjacent to the newly founded Library of Ptolemy in the fortress. The chapel, now an oddly lustrous place thanks to the permanence of the Pharos link, was the site for all audiences with faraway Sotha.
"The lion himself, sir," Titus Prato replied. "His fleet translated in system just a few hours ago."
"So the lion emerges," murmured Dantioch. "He comes to support Lord Gilliman, I trust."
"It would appear so, though he brings with him a fleet force of dark angels that might have split the planet in two," Prato said.
It was a curious experience to be at once standing in a candle-lit chapel and looking into a gleaming abyssal cave of the tuning floor.
"So he is our salvation," Dantioch said.
"He is our hope," Prato corrected. "It appears he has 20,000 dark angels with him. That number could turn any tide."
Prato paused.
"I sense unease in you, Titus. You greet me with today's momentous news of the lion's arrival, but there is another reason for this conversation."
"You sense?" Prato replied with a quizzical smile.
Now, sir, I am no psyker," replied the warsmith.
A heavy, high-backed seat had been set on the tuning floor, so that Dantioch did not have to stand throughout the audiences. Some of his tactical conversations with Gilliman lasted for hours. The warsmith eased his position a little and succumbed to a rasping cough.
"The quantum tuning of the Pharos device is empathic, and the more I use it, the more I am aware I can read demeanour. What do you hesitate from saying?"
"Alexis Pollux of the Imperial Fists has requested an audience with you, sir."
Dantioch stiffened slightly as the hulking Imperial Fist stepped into the communication field beside Prato and became visible. Pollux had removed his helm. He gazed directly at Dantioch's masked face.
"Captain," said Dantioch.
"Warsmith," Pollux replied.
"I have been advised of your actions in the Foul system, sir," said Dantioch. "I am used to the sons of loyal legions regarding me with suspicion, but I imagine you have more cause to distrust me than most."
"I reserve judgment," replied Pollux.
"This means of communication," Dantioch said, "as I was reminding the librarian, enhances empathic vibrations. You hate me. I can feel it."
"I have not quite done killing Iron Warriors, sir," Pollux replied.
"I am quite sure the Iron Warriors have not done killing Imperial Fists either," Dantioch said, "but I stand apart from their actions. Do not judge me by..."
"Sir," said Pollux, "Primarch Gilliman has asked me to assist in the provisions of security and fortification for McCrag and its system. I have made it my business to personally inspect all potential flaws and weaknesses."
"You feel that I am a weakness?" asked Dantioch.
"Your legion has turned," said Pollux. "Yet you are here, charged no less with the control of a device at once vital to Ultramar's survival, and yet technologically still a mystery. That is a dangerous combination. The navigational viability of the 500 worlds is entrusted to a man who might be an enemy. How better to undermine the fortress of Ultramar than to get inside and gain a position of trust and vast responsibility? I would know if this is your siege craft, purposed to bring Lord Gilliman's domain down."
You are direct, at least, said Dantioch. But if you learn to read the tuning field's vibrations, you will see my true intent well enough. Besides, if I had been seeking to undermine Ultramar, Captain, it would have fallen already.
You seek to distance yourself from your traitor kin, said Pollux. He pointed at Dantioch with his crimson, grafted hand. That mask is not helping. Dantioch's iron mask was fashioned to resemble the emblem of the Fourth Legion.
The mask hides nothing, Pollux, said Dantioch, and it does not come off. Rather than reminding you of my association and origin, it should remind you how far some will go to remain loyal. This tells you something about metal, sir. This mask shows you that some men will wear a badge of shame forever, so that no one forgets the bonds they have broken in order to remain true.
Dantioch slowly rose to his feet.
The Imperial Fists and the Iron Warriors, Pollux, he said sadly. Let us not debate. Let us simply agree that of all the Legiones Astartes, they are the greatest in warcraft, the finest exponents of fortification, either of building defences or of overwhelming them. Together, sir, with our talents and vast experience pooled, we can make Macragge impregnable.
He coughed again, looking to his side, and took up a data slate from the heavy arm of his seat. His gauntleted hand shook slightly at the effort.
Now that the Pharos is operational, he said, I have been giving time to the consideration of defence in the Macragge system. Speculation, really. Some suggestions. A number of integrated schemes that might work well.
He looked at Pollux.
This might be the way to prove my loyalty to you, Captain.
How?
We talk, said Dantioch. Every day, if necessary, I share every plan and idea I have with you. Every secret of my warcraft, including concepts the Iron Warriors have regarded as private law since their foundation, I will betray my traitor kin. Captain, I will tell you all of my secrets until you see through this mask and believe that only a truly loyal warrior could give up so much.
Gilliman finished reading the report and then looked at Yuton.
Why didn't you wake me? He asked.
You needed rest. Besides your injuries, you spent too long drinking that foul brew with the heathens last night.
Mjod is an interesting concoction, Gilliman agreed. As for the wolves, I like their honesty. I like much less battle brothers who hide their intentions and make guile a weapon.
Battle brothers in general? Yuton asked. Or one in particular?
I'm thinking of one brother especially, said Gilliman.
He rose from his daybed.
Is it really the lion? He asked.
In such strength, she replied, that he could have been a serious threat had he not come peacefully.
Of all of them, why did it have to be him who found a way through the storm? Gilliman whispered.
Yuton pretended she had not heard. She waited patiently.
I admire him, Gilliman said more audibly, looking at his stoic chamberlain. Throne, who wouldn't? It's impossible not to admire him. But there is always a shadow on him. He dwells in secrets. He plays his cards too close, and he walks by himself when he pleases. There is too much of the wild forest in him. He should be as noble as any of my beloved brothers, but we have never been close, and there is too much about him that is sly. This will be an interesting reunion. I wonder what agenda brings him all the way to Ultramar.
It could be nothing more sinister than shelter from the warp, replied Yuton. You'll find out. The lion is coming. I suggest you put on full plate and welcome him in a manner that befits his eminence. Any loyal son, you said. Well, one has come to you out of the storm.
In the opinion of most rational observers, the Primarch of the First Legion, Dark Angels, was the most potent and potentially dangerous individual to visit Macragg since its illumination. There was another strong candidate for that title, however, though his arrival was rather more clandestine. Sometimes he used the name John. The immigration halls of the Helion orbital plate were vast, but now they were overcrowded and had begun to smell. Helion was the outermost grav-adjusted hard anchorage circling Macragg, and the largest and oldest of all the capital world's orbital plates. Battleships, bulk carriers, barges, and gross tenders clung to the edges of it like piglets to a sow's teats. Macragg, a gleaming grey marble, whirled with white cloud, rolled slowly beneath the floating island. John had been trying to find a way off the Helion plate since he'd arrived there 6 days before.
"This is cruel, cruel, I tell you," sobbed Madarin, holding her hungry baby against her neck.
She was 21, Terran standard. Her baby, John forgot the name of the poor thing, but knew he could fetch it out of her mind in a moment if he had to, had been born aboard the filthy refugee ship from Kalth. The newborn's father, an army regular in one of the numinous regiments, had died back on Kalth and had never seen his son. He had never even known he was going to have a son. Madarin was marked, a sunburned blush on the right side of her pretty face. The child was marked too, John noticed, an extra toenail on the underside of the second toe, left foot. The mark of Kalth, legacies of a biome corrupted by toxins, munition dust, heavy metals and solar radiation.
"Cruel," she whispered, subsiding.
"I know it is," John said, soothing her. He could smell the stale odours of his own body and the reek of the hall around them. There was crying and wailing everywhere, echoed by the orbital's unforgiving acoustics.
"What is Gilliman thinking?" asked old Habard.
He coughed, shaking his head.
"I thought he was a kind king, a noble man, but he keeps us penned like animals."
"I thought he was a warrior," grumbled the sulking youth Tulik. "Some warrior, he let Kalth get scoured to ashes."
"Come on, hush, all of you," John said. "We've all been through hard times. Our beloved Primarch... And let's be respectful, shall we, old man?" John looked at Habard, who shrugged and nodded in apologetic agreement. "Our noble Primarch," John went on, putting his hand on old Habard's shoulder to reassure him, "he's been through a hard time too. He's hounded here, enemies at his door. I'm sure he's doing his best to look after us all."
"This is his best?" Madarin asked.
"I was talking to the guards last shift," John said.
"Guards now, guards, is it? Why would they have to guard us, poor damn victims in all this?"
Habard asked. "Shh now, old fella," said John. He dropped his voice to a conspiratorial whisper and edged up the persuasion in his psyche. "Enemies at the door," he told them. The wide-eyed circle of desperate refugees crowded into the corner of the gloomy hall. "The guards are as much for our benefit as anything. These are bad times. We all know that. Bad, dark times. God knows, an age of darkness. Security's tight, it's got to be. They want to let us down to the welcome camps in the city, but they have to hold us here while they check us out. Check identities, confirm our status as metics."
"Metics?" Tulik asked.
"Resident aliens," John said. "It'll be a temporary classification until we are assigned full citizenship. Anyway, they're using the orbitals as way stations to process us as we come in. That's what the guards told me last shift."
"Okay."
Some of them smiled because they were reassured. Some of them smiled at the comfort of his odd vocabulary, the okay thing. Some of them smiled because he had managed a subtle adjustment of their amygdala.
"Please," said Madarin, "can't you talk to them again, Ol?"
"Okay," he said. He trudged up the grilled staircase to the main landing deck. He heard moans and complaints from below as the ghostly blue light of the ultraviolet sterilizing lamps came on. Every few hours the lamps bathed the holding halls in a radiance that made everyone feel nauseous. The ultraviolet wash was meant to keep them clean of lice and bacteria. He fought to hold back the misery of the 30,000 refugees in the deck pens below. The weight of it could easily unbalance a mind as sensitive as his. Yet coming up was harder still. On the main deck, he was obliged to contend with the constant pain of the Thalax guards. The towering Mechanicum meatborgs watched over the entire yard area, brutal and spare, glowering like butcher birds, striding around on piston limbs. John wasn't sure what was harder to handle, the empathy or the knowledge. He hated the Psychana backwash of the Thalaxi. He could smell their pain. He could feel and see that behind every polished blank faceplate was a human skull with its spinal column still attached, screaming in agony, neurally threaded to the unforgiving steel frame that it wore. He also knew why the orbiter was being guarded by a Thalax heavy retinue, however, and that fact was difficult to deal with. He could read the order sequence plainly in their howling, fizzling brains. The plate had been staffed by Mechanicum Automata with a skeleton staff of Ultramarine supervisors in case it had to be sacrificed at short notice. Helion could be auto-destructed with a minimum loss of Legionis Astartes.
"Return below,"
the nearest of the Thalaxi commanded, pistoning towards him, pneumatics puffing, weapons cycling.
"I want to talk to the officer in charge," John said.
"Identify yourself," the automaton said.
"You know me, Key 8 Virto. We talked just a while ago," he said.
"Accessing records,"
the machine replied, hesitating.
"What's the problem here?" asked the base supervisor, approaching them. The supervisor was an ultramarine sergeant. John hot-read him in a flash. Ambitious.
"Sir, I was just asking about waiting times and conditions," John said. The ultramarine looked down at him. Helm off, the warrior was oddly out of proportion, a too small head on a too big body.
"What's your name?" asked the ultramarine.
"Al Person," said John.
He'd been wearing his old friend's identity ever since he'd joined the refugee ship during a stopover at Occluder. Al was an easy role to play. He'd been a farmer on Kalth, after all, and his name would be on the population lists. It was easier to play an old friend. There were fewer cover details to remember.
"You've come from Kalth?" asked the ultramarine sergeant.
"Zyrol," John read. His name was Zyrol.
"Yes, sir," John lied.
"What were you back there?"
"A farmer, sir."
The ultramarine nodded, compassionate.
"These are tough times, Al," he said.
"They are," John agreed.
He felt a sudden unexpected twinge of guilt. He thought of the real Al Person, his very real friend. He thought of the task he'd set for Al, the danger he'd put him in. He thought about all the things at stake. Right now, Al was cutting his way across... No. John regained control, regained clarity. He couldn't afford to think that way. Worry and fear made him vulnerable.
"There are a lot of women and children below," John said, gesturing towards the holding decks. "God knows they could use proper help and not confinement here."
"God?" asked the sergeant.
"Apologies, sir. A slip of the tongue. Old habits die hard."
"You're what? Catheric?"
"Yes, sir."
"Play the role. Play the role."
"Renounced, of course."
"So what are you, a spokesman?" asked the ultramarine.
"I guess. We've been here a while, sir. Days. Before that, 10 months on a carrier from the ruins of Kalth. We thought..."
"I know it's bad, Al," said the sergeant.
John read the legionary's ambition more closely and saw it for what it really was, a kind of nobility. Sergeant Zyrol wanted honour. He wanted promotion. He wanted the transverse broom crest of a centurion. To earn that, he knew he had to be just like his Primarch, open and honest, compassionate, caring, serious, truthful, firm, effective. This was not an act. This was his belief model. It was in his gene code. "Women and kids down there," John said, "waiting. It's getting hard for them, do you see? To be at the doorstep of sanctuary and yet denied." "New protocols, all," replied the sergeant with a shake of his head. "First Master Augustine brought them in. We are obliged to hold, question, and search them. Trust me, we hate to do it. You people deserve all the support McCragg can give you." Augustine. The name flamed up in the sergeant's mind. These new security measures weren't Ultramarines protocols, in John's estimation. 13th Legion security was all about guns on walls. This was Iron Warriors-style countermeasures. Long-term planning, arm's-length caution. No, given the way the cards had fallen, not 4th Legion. No, more like 7th Tactics. Imperial Fists. John probed harder, caught a quick memory flash of Zyrol watching his superior, Augustine, taking the credit for a security scheme orchestrated by someone called Pollux. Augustine. Asshole. Note to memory. Adjust. A new strategy. Zyrol was not going to bend, nor was he going to badmouth his asshole superior, but he was noble. He wanted to be like Gilliman. He wanted to stand for honour and duty. "What's that, sir, over there?" John asked, pointing across the vast hangar space of the orbital deck. Zyrol sighed. "The dead," he replied. About half a kilometre away, across the rockcrete and adamantium cargo floor of the orbital's western dock, sarcophagus capsules were being unloaded via suspensor webs into the open maw of a cargo lander. "The dead?" John echoed. He was pushing a gentle mental finger into the sergeant's frontal lobe dopamine system. "We're repatriating the fallen of the 13th to the Memorial Gardens for interment." "You?" John paused for effect. He amped his emotions so that tears would well. "You prioritize the dead over the living?" he asked. "It's not like that, all," the sergeant protested, suddenly guilt-stricken. John shook his head and walked away. It was all right. He'd already secured from Zyrol's surface thoughts the name of the officer in charge of landing schedules. John shed the all-person guise as easily as one might take off a coat. He adjusted and became Teo Lusulk, a fleet intelligence officer assigned to the orbital. He gained access to a prep room and acquired a clean flight suit and a carry bag to stash his possessions in. He was particularly careful with one item. It was heavy, but not much bigger than a short sword. John had wrapped it in silk cloth, and he further bundled it inside his dirty clothes. As he changed garments and cleaned himself up, John allowed the mark of Kalth that he had psychosomatically applied to his left cheek and forehead to begin fading. He walked into the busy control ring levels of the orbital's western watchtower. The great arched windows were open to permit a view across the grey cityscape of the Titanic plate, the shoals of ships beyond, glinting in hard light and sharp shadows, and then the bright and vast sweep of sunlit McCrag, painfully lit against the throbbing darkness of the void. Operational code Magenta, he decided. If the day's status was higher than scarlet, the window ports would have been automatically blast-shuttered. Passing as someone you are not was all about confidence, the confidence of body language and mind state. John simply walked through the bustle of fleet staffers and servitors, passing Thalaxi sentries and ultramarine security without even glancing at them. He was stopped once at the hatchway into a strategium. "Papers and ident," the ultramarine said, his voice a glottal drawl emanating from his vox grill. "Of course, sorry," John replied. He made a show of searching his flight suit pockets. At the same time, he planted a thought seed in the ultramarine's head.
"Apologies, Lusulk," the space marine said, waving him through. "Didn't recognize you, friend."
The strategium was humming with data flow. Tactical officers, intelligencers, and mechanicum adepts worked around the glowing hololithic display tables. John picked up a data slate and pretended to consult it as he moved closer. He read dispositions. Near orbit and high anchorage were both packed tight as a drum. So many ships. Close to a third of the Ultramar war fleet, by the looks of it, and another big fleet had recently taken up station in McCragg's Polar Range. Were those Dark Angels ships? First Legion? Holy hell! Holy shitting hell! John looked closer, reading the fine detail. There was a standoff. It was subtle, but none of the Dark Angels' vessels were out of gun sweep from either the Ultramarines' war fleet or the principal weapon orbitals. Shit, what did Gilliman think his brother Legion was going to do? Of course. Of course. The answer was almost anything. The galaxy had been turned upside down. No one trusted anybody. What else? What the hell was that navigation beacon? Since when did McCragg have an astronomicon? Except it wasn't an astronomicon. John could feel it. He could feel the light of it pulsing in his brain and heart and spine and balls. It was xenotech. Gilliman was using some kind of xenotech to pierce the warp storm and make the 500 worlds navigable. Holy, holy hell! The galaxy had turned upside down. Even sane men were resorting to desperate measures. The xenotech was ugly. It was an ugly light, an old light, like a lamp lit eons earlier. John didn't like it. It reminded him of something that had lurked deep in the acuity he had shared with his alien puppet masters in the Cabal. A species memory, a memory of old time, of pre-humanity. It was tech that had taken others across the Gulf of Stars, long before man, long before the Eldar, even. The feeling made him shiver. It made him fear for his own kind, for mankind, even though he had been a traitor to his kind for longer than he cared to remember. He was an agent of the Cabal. He wondered for how much longer. John Grammaticus had a conscience, despite all evidence to the contrary. How much longer before he would finally be forced to acknowledge what his conscience was telling him and pay it some heed? How much longer before he let it guide his actions? The galaxy had turned upside down. What else had to happen before he finally told his alien masters to go screw themselves? His alien masters would kill him, of course, permanently this time. John crossed to the next hololithic display table, a downsweep view of McCragg. He bumped into a good-looking female officer who was turning away from the table. "Sorry," he said, picking up the data slate she'd dropped. She smiled. As he handed it back to her, he got a decent hot read as his mind brushed hers. Her name was Leonina, which was nice, but not important. More significantly, he took her console access codes out of her head, like plucking individual whisker bones out of the cooked flesh of a good piece of fish. John got to the table and keyed the code into the fascia panel. He had data access. He started to work, carefully and methodically, trying not to make it look like he was gorging on information. He pulled up meteorological views, disposition spreads and data slides. He dragged as much of it as he could over to his borrowed data slate, his hand moving through the motion-conductive light cloud. Some of the data was rebuffed and wouldn't copy to his device because his clearance wasn't high enough. He copied what he could and memorized what he couldn't. It was extremely demanding keeping up a psych disguise in such a crowded and vigilant environment. John reckoned he could do it for 30 minutes, tops, before his controls started to fray. This was his one shot at learning how the ground lay. He looked at McCragg. According to the Cabal, his target was down there somewhere, somehow. John had been many things for them. Procurer, suborner, spy, panderer, recruiter, persuader, provocateur, iconoclast, thief. He'd never been an assassin before. He rotated the table view and rolled the three-dimensional globe of McCragg around on its axis, flicking aside the meteorological overlays and air traffic schemes. He wanted security data. He got it. He'd been hoping for a teleport entry, but that was clearly out of the question. Some supremely clever bastard had retrained a modest proportion of the orbital AuSpec systems to watch the surface. Clever. Oh, very clever. Any teleport burst would be seen and logged. The same applied to unauthorized drop pods or landers. That was definitely Imperial Fist's thinking. You can't keep everyone out. What you can do is know if they have got in. What else? Well, authorized Planet 4 was restricted to the primary starport, and the primary damn starport looked wide open. But it wasn't, because starship-quality void fields had been set up to close down the lower orbital tracks and the entire port area at a second's notice. So, zero chance of stealing a lander and then pleading code ignorance on the final approach. They'd just slam him out of the air. John Grammaticus sighed. Sweat was starting to bead on his forehead. It looked as if he was going to have to go with a crazy improvisation that had crossed his mind earlier. Tio Lasulk became an army officer called Idaris Cluet, who was attached to the repatriation process. As Helion Plate was overtaken by the Terminator and night fell, Cluet boarded a bulk transport and stood, solemn and dignified in his mourning uniform, alongside other officers of his stripe, beside a row of sarcophagi. A fanfare sounded. Lifting on hot blue burners, the transport rose and moved out of the orbital bay.